Good morning.
My name is John O'Neill, and I am a staff chaplain at the Washington Correction Center in Shelton, Washington. Our prison is approximately 6 miles out of town, and it's a facility for originally established for first-time offenders. It no longer fills that role. Now we have everything from first offenders on up to 2 and 3 time losers. A lot goes by age, and that's kind of hard to figure out too, simply because we run a group of from about 15 to 72. I think those are the outer limits both ways. I thought I would start this morning giving you a little background on myself, where I come from, how I'm involved, what my ministry is. I am a licensed lay minister. I am not ordained. I have been approved by Lutheran Council USA Ecclesiastical Endorsement for prison ministry and specialized ministry, and I'm in a process of going a little higher within the district and the national at this point. I've been associated at Shelton now with Chaplain Ray Lester, who was here last week, for approximately 2 years. A little history about myself. My background is engineering, but I am an ex-offender. I served about 3 years in the prison in Shelton. I've been, that's over 13 years ago, approximately 13 years ago. And I guess I would like to lead up a little bit to what I've been doing. I've been involved at Holden for a number of years. In fact, is my original experience at Holden Village was when I was went on parole in 1970, and I came up to the village, and this was my first experience here. And I've been involved at Holden Village in one way or another for a number of years since then. I haven't been here since 79, working in the prison since then. I am chairman of the Criminal Justice Task Force of the North Pacific District of the ALC, and involved in clinical pastoral education at Shelton, which is under the supervision of Ray Lester. My attempt this week is not to give you any idea that I have the answers in our criminal justice system, or a method of curing it, or helping it, or doing much with it. My main reason and point for being here, and I'd like sharing with you, is to acquaint you with the criminal justice system, with life in prison. There are no simple, easy answers. None whatsoever. We deal with all facets of problems, of types of felonies, of crimes, from the baby rapers on up to first degree murder. Our facility is actually made up of two prisons, in a sense. We have what we call the reception center, which every male offender committed to the Department of Corrections in the state of Washington goes through the reception center. At that point, they are classified into age bracket, offenses, they're tested, they're giving numerous tests to psychological as well as educational, see what their level of learning is, and then possibly they appear before the parole board for their minimum sentence. Now, I think you have to understand the state of Washington has a our method of sentencing offenders is that by law every offense is broken down into a category and given a mandatory or a maximum sentence. Each felony has a different amount of time tied to it. And the judge is required by law to sentence up to whatever that might be. Burglary 1, for instance, I believe is 10 years. The judge sentences that individual if he either pleads guilty or is tried and by jury and found guilty, then the judge is required to sentence that man to 10 years maximum, up to 10 years. Then the prosecuting attorney and the judge can then recommend the minimum sentence. 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, whatever, up to the maximum. But it's up to the parole board then to decide what that minimum is going to be. So what happens is a man then is sent down to the reception center, and we receive him there, and he goes through the routine. He's there from 1 to 3 months, and then he's been classified. He's classified for one of the various institutions that we have. Now we have the training center, which is Shelton, Washington. Called a training center, strictly a prison. We have McNeil Island now, which was the federal penitentiary. We have Walla Walla, which is the real big house of the state of Washington and recognized as one of the toughest prisons in the United States, one of the most harsh. Then we have Monroe, up at Monroe, which is called a reformatory, again, a prison, very simply. We have a what we call Furlans, which is the north end of Seattle, which is a minimum security facility. Certainly no one but first offenders go there, and generally minor crimes. We have numerous camps throughout the state. We have Larch Mountain down near Vancouver, Washington. We have Cedar Creek Correction Center, which is up by about 30 miles south of Olympia. We have Clearwater Correction Center, which is out by Forks, Washington, out on the peninsula. We have Indian Ridge, which is another camp, forest camp, up by Arlington, Darrington, which is the north part of the state, and up that way. In addition to that, we have Pine Lodge Correction Center over on this side of the mountains, up towards Spokane, and we have Geiger Field Pre-Release, which is also up by Spokane. And they're areas that offenders go out to after they've served a certain amount of time. Here again, it's hard to categorize, depending on the individual, his crime, whether it's a violent one or they classify as nonviolent, determines a lot what happens to him. The programs that we have in our institutions at this time are very, very limited. we have practically no form of rehabilitation at this time. At Shelton, we're fortunate to have the high school that allows those who have not completed a high school education to continue and get their diploma or at least a GED. We did have up until this year, and at this point, I don't know where it is, we had a college program that allowed the inmates to get up to an AA degree in various areas. Any area that can be completed within the institution without having to go out. In addition to that, we have vocational schooling. We have auto repair, body and fender. They have a barber school. They have a meat cutting school. Welding, woodworking, carpentering, blueprint reading, these types of programs are all available to the inmate. And I want to clarify that. Available, space available, because there is not room to take care of all of them, simply because we are well overcrowded at this point. Our reception center, built for 240 inmates, now houses over 400. We're running a daily census in the institution, the training center and the reception center, of about 1,180 people. The facility was originally built for approximately 800. This leads to a lot of problems. Overcrowding is a problem that is most difficult to deal with. We do have, in a program of counseling, the chaplaincy. And in addition to that, we have two psychologists available. We're in the process now of establishing a mental health facility there, about 5 beds, and then outpatient treatment for the inmates. We have a number of halls. When a man comes to the training center, he goes into Spruce Hall, which is an intake hall, an extension of the R units, or the reception center. We call it R units for short. And he stays there from 30 to 90 days in that more or less maximum security facility. And I should back up a little bit. The reception center is maximum security. The men come in there on a chain, literally, from throughout the state of Washington, on our big buses and vans, and it is literally a chain. They are chained up. They're allowed out of their cells then an hour in the morning for yard, an hour in the afternoon for yard, and then meal times. And they eat right in their own facility. We have three cell blocks, R1, R2, and R3. R1 is basically houses guys that have been down 2 or 3 times, or more or less hardened offenders, criminals, whatever you want to call them. R2 is an intermediate group, and R3 are the less violent, less usually kids that have been down the first time and are kids that are really scared. Fact is, they're all scared. Well, if they're assigned then to the correction center, they go over to the Spruce Hall, which is is maximum security for the training center. And if they follow the rules and do as they're told and so forth, they then get out into what we call population, or out into one of the other halls, which allows them their own room and to some degree move about the institution at will. That is structured. They're allowed to move back and forth to school, to voc training, to the hospital, meals, of course, and that type of thing. It's all done on pass. Up until about a year and a half ago, when we had our riot, our first riot at Shelton, which did something close to $1 million worth of damage, they moved pretty freely. Everybody moved back and forth, and no big problem. That's been definitely curtailed now, and there's no large movement of individuals. It's very, very structured. After a man has been in Spruce for approximately anywhere from 30 to 90 days, depending on his own attitude and how he behaves, he is then put out into population. We have three halls: Cedar, Evergreen, and Pine Hall, which are all population halls. And we have another hall called Birch Hall, which houses mostly those people who cannot get along in population. Basically, sex offenders, baby rapers, people who are maybe real young, open to harassment by other inmates, that type of thing. They go to Birch Hall. And that hall is pretty much, their whole movement is controlled. It's protective custody to a degree, what we call protective custody. Mm-hmm. From that point on, they're generally programmed. Everybody is supposed to program. And that is where part of the system breaks down. In addition to the group from the chaplaincy standpoint, we have going there what we call a clinical pastoral education program, CPE. Some of you may be aware of what that is. Ray Lester, as I mentioned, is the supervisor of that. He conducts this group. And it's made up, the past unit we just completed, is made up of an intern. We have an intern from Luther Sem. We had a student from PLTS in Berkeley. We have a Pentecostal lay minister from the Shelton area. And we had and myself and Paul Anderson, who is a Lutheran pastor from east of the mountains here, who is involved in our program. And we all act as chaplains throughout the prison. That gives us about six people in this institution for ministry. And we can't scratch the surface. There is just no way that we can scratch the surface. We try. We deal with the griefs and the pains of human beings. We deal with their families. Wives, parents, fiancés, girlfriends, and we deal with the individual on a counseling basis. We have, Ray has a group called, it's a therapy group for sex offenders, and he deals directly with that group in a group setting, and also deals on a one-to-one basis. We have a group called Brothers Keepers Movement, which is this little pin I wear. That is a group of young men or men in the institution who attempt to help their other inmates, which is sorely needed within the institution. And then we have a group called Prison Fellowship or Christian Fellowship, which meets, these groups meet once a week. And this is an attempt to involve people in a little more structured church setting, religious setting, whatever you want to call it. Our primary function that we're charged with is the to ensure the religious freedom of every inmate there, whatever they choose to follow. We can no way try to guide them into any particular denomination or type of religion. Consequently, we deal with about every type of religious group that you can think of. We have a Catholic chaplain that comes in once a week on Sundays, conduct Mass. We have a Muslim imam who comes in twice a week, or twice a month, excuse me, for the Muslim services. They're both on a contract basis. Then in addition to that, we have numerous church groups that come in. We have a four-square gospel church that comes down from Bellevue. We have a group that comes in from Shelton. We have a group that comes in from Olympia, and a number of volunteer-type groups that serve and help us in the ministry there. Basically, that pretty much covers the physical facility and what it is and what it's doing. I don't want to lead you into thinking that we're the criminal justice system is all bad. There's some very good things about it, but there's also a lot of bad in it. The custody people that we deal with, we as chaplains walk a very, very fine line. We must maintain credibility with the custody and staff, and we must maintain credibility with the inmate. Otherwise, we cannot operate, we cannot function. So that requires us to be very careful of how we deal, what we deal with, and where we get involved. We cannot do much with a man's time structure. We deal, hopefully, with where he is with his God. Maybe introduce him to his God and his brother for the first time. Custody people, the priority in any prison in the state of Washington, and I'm sure this holds true for any prison, federal or otherwise, is custody. Primarily because you, as taxpaying members of our society, mandate that we have places to put people and that they be maintained. And with what they have to work with, I think the state does a pretty good job of it, based on what society has mandated. Part of my hope this week is to acquaint you and make you aware of the problems that we're dealing with, hopefully to more to educate than anything else, to make you aware of what's happening, where your tax dollars are going, what's happening to your people from your community. And I would venture to say that there isn't a person in this room whose community we don't have some of their people. It's really interesting sometimes what you run into. Custody has a tough job. We are dealing with a lot of tough people in all of our prisons. And I'm not here to tell you that we should turn them all loose. No way. The burnout rate for our custody people is fantastic. They get about a month off a year. They try to break it up 2 weeks at a time. Hopefully they'll get to the point someday where they'll give them a month every 6 months because they need it. You cannot deal with these people day in and day out, 5 days a week. Sometimes these guys double back and they'll do 18, 20 hours of work because of the shortage of people in the institution, that is staff people, custody people. And they're burned out. A lot of these people are concerned people, the guards, and I think we've been programmed to think about them as men with whips, and they're not. We do have some that are pretty sadistic, no question about that. But by and large, most of them are concerned, but they really are not allowed to be concerned. They don't dare be too concerned, because if they do, they're going to get eaten up. We have to be very careful of how we deal with people in the prison. Because these guys are con-wise, they're sharp, they have nothing to do but sit around all day and figure out ways and means of beating the system. And they can run all kinds of tricks on you. I've had numerous ones run on me, and I thought I knew most of the tricks. I've been on both sides of the fence, I know what it is. I know what it is to go through prison and be part of it. I also know what it is to be a chaplain in the prison, and that's been a really exciting, eye-opening experience for me, and I enjoy it. It's fulfilling, frustrating. But we're dealing with a segment of society who are tough to deal with. And I guess I would have to say at this point that it can happen to any of us. Any of us sitting in this room can wind up in Shelton. And you may think that's kind of far-fetched, but believe me, it is not. There's just many, many ways this can happen. We all have emotions, we all have angers, we all have problems to deal with that most of us deal with them in a healthy way. Or we come from a good family, or we've come from a family who have at least tried to guide and direct us. But even in those cases, the emotions sometimes get away. I think we're dealing with a group of people who their values, for whatever reason, have been really distorted. It's kind of interesting when you talk to guys who fall into what we call the criminal personality. And you realize that, hey, what's yours is mine, and what's mine is my own. They don't have any real sense of stealing something. It's mine anyway. And, you know, they don't really deal with the person that they're ripping off. They see something, and they want it for whatever reason, and they take it. Or they get involved in a fight, and possibly drug or or alcohol is involved, and things happen. The situation in Bellevue here, last May, I believe it was, when the young couple coming out of a movie were accosted by two guys that gave them a lot of lip and made some snide remarks to the young lady that was with them, and outcome of that was simply two guys getting shot to death. It's hard for us to visualize or understand how these things can happen. Please believe me, they can and do. And the interesting part is that probably about 80% of those people who get involved in that type of crime, or get involved in, for want of a better term for it, crimes of passion, 80% of them never reoffend. They're probably the safest group around. Even though the crime has been a very violent one, not necessarily gross, but violent. Where death results in one way or another. 70 to 80% of those people never reoffend. Approximately 25% of the people we're dealing with in prisons need to be locked up and almost the key thrown away. There's a percentage that have degraded to the point of animals because they live in an animal existence. It's a survival lifestyle.
What percentage was that?
Beg your pardon?
What percentage are you talking about there?
Of which?
Of the people who are degenerated to the animal.
Approximately 25%. They have they live in an environment of daily fear, 24 hours a day. There's more rape goes on in prison than there is outside. We deal with drugs. We deal with alcohol within the system, within the prison. Drugs is a big business in prison. Alcohol is, they make their own. Call it Pruno. Violent stuff. Wild. But they make it.
How do they make it?
I'd like to wait till about... I'm going to present, and then I'll give you time to ask questions here. Save that one. It's a good one. They live with looking over their shoulder. Paranoia is built into the system. And they're continually afraid. Particularly the young kids coming in. Well, some of these kids come in, there's 17, 18 years old, and, you know, they're beautiful as far as the inmates are concerned. They're game. They're looking for them. And if they don't stand up and fight, they're going to get raped. We have homosexuality. It's a struggle all the time with that. And being a state institution, we have to deal with it on that level. Some of the people involved are dress up. They wear lipstick. Eye makeup, the whole bit. We try to curtail that. Custody watches that very closely, but it still happens. We have knifings. We have beatings. Fortunately, Shelton, to this point, has not had a death from a knifing or a beating. We've had some suicides, but that's been the extent of it. And it's impossible for custody to watch everything that goes on every minute. It just is an impossibility. But as I say, I think they do a very fine job of, with what they have to work with. That's pretty much a outline of my institution where I work. And I'd like to share for the next few minutes here some little background of where prisons started. Punishment and the ancient forms of punishment leading up to where we are today. Our society is punishment oriented and not rehabilitation oriented. We don't make any great attempt to rehabilitate our people we have in prisons. The main impetus is punishment. Make them pay for what they did. But no attempt, or very little attempt, to rehabilitate that person and bring him back into society as a useful citizen. Our society rejects these people by and large. They come out of prison on parole, and it's probably the most traumatic situation they go through, to go back into civilian life after society, after being in prison anywhere from 1 to 10 years or whatever. Society has passed them by. The economics have gone wild. They can't. They have no way of dealing with this, and they're scared of it. They've got to find a job, and unfortunately, we reject these people. And there isn't any of us that can be rejected too long before we just give up. So what happens is the person, after being rejected 3 or 4 times, or maybe only once, depending on how strong he is, or what kind of a family support he has, or what kind of support he has at all on the outside, just gives up and goes back to his comfort zone, the area where people know him and he gets along and they understand him and he understands them, and neither one of them trust each other, but they survive. And first thing you know, he's back into drugs or alcohol or whatever his particular expertise in crime is concerned. He starts ripping people off or ripping off gas stations or holding up grocery stores or whatever. So we just kind of compound what's going on. Got a vicious circle going here. The old laws that we read about back in biblical times, Moses' law, the law of Moses, the Roman legal system, and the code of Hammurabi, which I'm not familiar with at all. But these were legal systems of ancient times that dealt with punishment and dealing with their criminals. They were exotic in a lot of ways, very complicated, but they did not use prison incarceration as a form of punishment. Basically, they used their prisons to hold a person until they were tried and executed, or whatever the sentence was going to be, and then they were given that sentence, but it very, very seldom ever became incarceration. And later times in the in our system of punishment in Europe, Western Europe, became a very barbaric type of punishment. They used the stocks, They use flogging. Their hangings became public spectacles, and even women and children were beaten in public for minor crimes. It became a show for people to watch. And even then, incarceration was not a form of punishment, with the exception of political prisoners and those at that time, debtors' prison, which they held them for long periods of time until they paid their debts. But incarceration as a form of punishment did not come along until, it's almost a modern concept almost. They had a lot of brandings, things like that, very harsh, crucial type punishment. Crude type punishment, I should say. Brutal. Then, when they started the mass deportation of criminals from the old world to the new, they carried on some of this type of things in the New World, in Australia and the United States and so forth. Or what became the colonies, what became the United States. But imprisonment just was not used as a penalty. The Quakers introduced the concept in colonial Pennsylvania of imprisonment. The first American prison was established in Philadelphia, which was the Walnut Street Jail, and was converted into a series of solitary cells where the offenders were kept in silent confinement. And they just put in one of these cells and left there. The theory was that they would become penitent, confessing their crime before God and thereby gaining a spiritual rehabilitation, hence the name penitentiary. In 1790, the state of Pennsylvania enacted laws making imprisonment the ordinary punishment for crimes. And by 1850, all the states had adopted similar laws. The concept of imprisonment as a principal form of punishment has since been exported from the United States to almost all Western nations. And what happened in a lot of cases, these people they put in these cells to think about what they'd done wrong went crazy. Couldn't stand the solitary four walls. And the same thing is happening today. Over 200 years later, we're still doing the same thing, and the only problem is it's gotten worse. Our crime situation is worse. We're still putting people in cells and locking them up. And we haven't gained anything except bigger and better prisons. Right now, the state of Washington has three prisons on the drawing board. Well, one is, I guess, being built at Monroe. One on the drawing board for Grandview over on this side of the mountains, and another one over just been approved at Clallam Bay.
The interesting thing is that the churches brought in this type of punishment. And I guess for me at this point, it's a need for the churches to take a look at what's going on. Now here again, let me underline, I am not advocating do-gooder approach. It takes a very knowledgeable approach. And we'll get into some of that later on in this week. do I contend? Open the doors and let them out. But I feel that we have to change our approach for a lot of reasons, which I will deal with as the week goes on. And I'm of the firm opinion that the only place we're going to be able to do this is through our churches, through new legislation, through education of every one of you, so that you commence to understand. It's a very, very complex problem, a very controversial problem that most people don't want to deal with. Most of us don't want to admit we've got these misfits out here. We'd like to keep them in the closet, but we can't. Sooner or later, we're going to have to face the reality that we have a problem in the United States. The United States incarcerates more people than any other nation in the world, with the exception of Russia and South Africa. The United States incarcerates people longer than any other nation in the Western world. Not a very bright picture. It's not a very nice picture. We're spending millions of dollars, I'd say billions of dollars, that are going down the tube. We've got to look at another approach. Okay, it's 11:30, and I guess I'm supposed to wind this up at 11:45 or so, right along in there. So I'd be very happy now to throw it open to questions. I'd like to answer your question on how they deal with Bruno. How do they make it? Well, pretty simple. You know, the guys work in the kitchen. So they get some prunes or some any kind of fruit, and they throw it into a pot, and they get some sugar, and they dump that in. Guys involved in it will each rip off a little sugar from the kitchen, wherever, the dining hall, however. Not too difficult to do. Maybe the guy working in the bakery gets some yeast, and first thing you know, they find a warm spot to put it. And they can find the warm spots out of sight, believe me. And after a bit, they've got Pruno. And it is violent. Rugged stuff. Rugged stuff. Drugs, another big problem. Another big problem.
How does this get in there?
Well, are you ready for this?
Visitors?
Yeah. That's one form. There are some times when staff bring it in. But by and large, the most drugs are brought in by women. And the way they get the drugs in, very simply, is a woman will, a girlfriend, a wife, whatever, she will bring the drugs, they put it in a balloon, and then they will insert that in the vagina. And then they bring that into the prison. And they go through shakedown and the scanner and so forth, and fine. They go in and meet with their husband, boyfriend, whatever. And after a little bit, she'll go out to the bathroom and remove the balloon, wash it off, put it in her mouth, go back into the visit room. And she'll kiss her husband or boyfriend or whatever and transfer it. And he'll swallow it. Then he will either regurgitate it down in the hall or let it pass. And that's the way it's done. Pretty gross. Big business.
How about heroin? Would it help to have tablets in the, you know what I mean? In the bathrooms themselves? Or would that be an invasion of privacy?
Oh yeah, that's an invasion of privacy. You can't do that.
Can't do that?
No. The only way they do, they get smart, you know, pretty soon they come in to spot people who are carrying, or packing, as they call it. And then they watch them pretty closely. But still in all, if you read Newsweek here, last week, I think it was, the week before last, the guy that flew into Florida from Columbia, I think it was, and they found 85 balloons of coke and heroin in his stomach. And the way they spotted him was that he was just too nervous. He was just more nervous than he should have been, so customs people jerked him out, and they finally had to do a surgery. I think it was 85 balloons of coke and heroin and stuff like that. Yes?
Well, before anybody might make a suggestion about what we could do, I have that. Could you give us your comments about how you would change the system? And just briefly, I realize it's a topic by itself, but you have any suggestions?
I have some, but I think we got to deal with, I'm going to deal with some of that later on in the week, and I would rather deal with it at that point and leave this time for, that would take the rest of your time for me to deal with that subject, but I'd be glad to deal with that. I don't have all the answers, don't misunderstand me. I have some ways I think that we need to look at, yes. And I'd be glad to deal with that. In fact, I've got it on my agenda. Yes?
Maybe speaking of men, is there a separate parallel system for women in Washington? Or
yes.
Is there some co-correction?
We have the Purdy Treatment Center, which is a women's prison at Purdy, Washington. Basically the same thing. It's kind of a neat place. They live a little better, except for their maximum security people. But same situation. They're going through the same things that the men do, too. Yes, Jen.
What position for prison and punishment? The worse we make it on you, the less you'll want to go back and do what you did that got you in here in the first place.
Fear never stopped anything.
No, but I mean, is that the presupposition?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, they say, well, you know, lock them up and punish them, and they won't do it again. You know, you slap the wrist and they won't do it again. But and you still try to instill fear of the place for a while, for a few months. They realize what's particularly the first offender, and in some cases it probably works, but by and large it doesn't. I think there was somebody over here. Yeah.
I was fishing recently, and in the camp were three prison guards. And they gave me a bit of data. I wonder if you can tell me if it's true or not true. You don't know. That is that new prisons now being built cost $55,000 per cell. And there are a number of amenities that must, by law, be instilled in these new cells, including color television sets. You know.
Well, I'll buy half of that. the cost, that's on the way, way, way low side, but that's right. We're building a new county jail. I'm covering in long line, but I'll give you.
I gotta go on a hike. I may
not
be here.
Oh, okay. Well, we're building a new county jail in Mason County, where I am. That particular unit is going to cost. It's a 40-bed unit, I think it is. It's going to cost $88,000 per bed to build. Now, that doesn't say anything about maintenance. That doesn't say anything about the stuff that's got to go in it, et cetera, et cetera. As far as color television sets in the cells, I think that's somebody's dreaming. Now, they do have color television sets in their day rooms in our facility, where the whole group can come down and sit in the day room and watch TV and so forth. They do have that, yes. But not in the cells. No way.
What is in the cell?
What is in the cell? A steel bed welded to the wall with a mattress on it. This is in the population area. There's a locker to hang their clothes. There's a little desk that they can write at, and one chair. And that's it.
What about their bathroom facilities?
Bathroom facilities in population is down in a public type situation. Showers, toilets, sink, etc. For those areas where they come out of their cells and so forth, out of their rooms and so forth, where the guards can watch through the windows and see what's going on and so forth. Now, Spruce Hall has their own toilet and sink. In their cell, their showers are public. That's open, you know. The cells in maximum security in the reception center, they have a toilet and a sink. sink and the showers are. Yes.
Then you mentioned about prevention of crime. Do you see capital punishment as having any deterring value at all?
I do not, personally do not. I have a real struggle with capital punishment for a number of reasons. First of all, I don't think it deters that type of crime. Secondly, I don't think we have the, my God speaks to me, I don't have that authority to judge that man's life, take that man's life, number two. And number three, I think it's very difficult for anybody to get a fair trial, and particularly if it happens to be a well-publicized crime where everybody knows about it. And I think, personally, now this is my personal feeling, and most churches have taken a real solid stand against capital punishment.
Well, I meant, will statistics bear it out? When states voted in, does the crime murder rate go down?
Everything I read today says it does not affect it too much one way or the other.
I don't think we have enough data to comment on that, though.
Big pardon?
I don't think we have enough data to comment on that. How can you talk about, well, it does not deter any crime or any crime or a category of crime when it's only been instigated in the United States in the last 30 years, maybe how many times? Listen, a dozen times. I think if you were saying, well, we've had 5,000 executions in the United States in the last 5 years, and over 10 years, then you've got some data points, but we don't have any data points to comment on. I think that's wrong.
Well, I think they have some pretty good data back over the years of what has happened.
Who has the data?
Well, there's federal records on it. There's a lot of state records on it.
I'd be interested in knowing how many executions have been held in the United States in the 20th century. I bet you it's 30.
Yeah, I can't answer that question. I don't really don't have the data.
I bet you we're not talking about 10,000. I bet you're not talking about 2,000, you know, in 80 years.
Very possible.
Yeah, with a population of anywhere from 120 to now 240 million people, we're talking about instances that are infinitesimal.
But we can compare other countries, though, too, can't we? Because the countries, like, I don't think Great Britain has it, and they can compare it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's basically been compared throughout the world.
Throughout
the world, it's considered generally that I don't think there's any great statistics that says, yeah, it deters crime, or any great statistics that says, hey, no, it doesn't. Yeah. I think it's...
Well, I've heard that some countries on drugs or any first offense, they'll cut a finger off or they'll cut their hand off, and then there isn't much crime because there's too much free cure for the persons in that nation that they know they're going to lose their hand.
Well,
is that true?
I don't know. That's
in other words, are we too
crime,
are we too humanitarian?
No, I don't think so. I would certainly not. I would hope not. We don't approach that one. But, for instance, here last week I just read or heard on the radio, I guess it was, that China took the, I think it was five people that attempted to hijack an airplane. And the month before they hijacked the airplane, and the next month they were executed. Well, I don't know.
Well, this may be another subject that may not take it on. But we live in California, and my husband and I belong to Seattle, the law enforcement. And that's gone down to the many great judges. And who are, should never be on the same. And this group is spreading. Are that is the most important one that you read about in the paper. and they aren't treated right, and it all goes back to the judge and the attorney who is having the case on. I used to work for an attorney, and I tell them, there's nothing more crooked than that.
Well,
after all, it's his living, and he's trying to meet the next guy. And the victim, the person in the middle that they're fighting over, he's or he isn't, whether it's right or wrong.
I think we have to understand that we've got some part of our system. First of all, if you've got lots of money, you're better off. You got a chance if you got the money, you can quite often beat the rat.
That's a disorganization.
Right.
One of the things that we're working
on. The other thing is that we, our criminal justice system is in politics, and when we're dealing with politics, we're dealing with a judge or a prosecuting attorney who has to keep his constituents happy, or he's not going to have a job. So, we're human beings, let's face it. I'm not pointing the finger, don't misunderstand me. That's all part of some of the things that need to be changed. I think that's a situation, I've heard about this before in other areas. And it's very, we'll get into some of that later on this week. So, yeah, I don't have any problem dealing with it. Sure.
I had an instance in my life where I got put in jail, and I was in there for about 2 hours. And when they shut that door, you just shut off from the rest of the world, and I didn't know how long I was in there. And just in that short period of time, I just lost track of everything. And I'd rather see 10 guilty men get set free because they couldn't prove they were guilty than one innocent person get put in that system. It's just being in a situation like that, just for a couple hours, I cherish that experience. And I think that, you know, when you look at what's going on in the judicial system, one thing you have to realize is you're not there, and you don't know every little detail or every little circumstance that goes on in that courtroom.
That's true.
And the judges are, I'm sure, very much aware of what they are going to subject someone to when they put them inside that system.
I would hope you're wrong, but I'm afraid you're right.
Yeah.
And, I know.
The punishment system, I have a lot of trouble with it.
Well, I think we need, as I said before, I think we need to look at the dynamic of punishment as opposed to the dynamic of rehabilitation. And I struggle with the word rehabilitation anyway, but at least start looking at a behavioral change pattern as opposed to just locking a guy up and expecting him to come out a new man, because he's not. He just is not going to come out.